Welcome to the Free to Choose Media Podcast. Today's podcast, originally recorded in 1978, is a discussion between legendary economist Friedrich Hayek and then economics graduate student Jack High. During the conversation, Hayek talks about his major influences in economics, as well as his upbringing in the social sciences. As they dive into Hayek's philosophical and professional development, they touch on famous names from history, such as John Maynard Keynes, Ludwig von Mises, and George Stigler. We hope you enjoy today's podcast and stop by each week for a new episode of the Free to Choose Media Podcast.
Professor Hayek, I believe you came from a family of natural scientists. How did you get interested in the social sciences?
Well, it's quite true. Although I had a maternal grandfather who was a constitutional lawyer and finally a statistician, but there's no influence from that side. The background was purely biological. In fact, it has been passed on to my children. I don't know quite how it happened. I think the decisive influence which interested me and which led me to be interested in politics was really World War I, and particularly the experience of serving into a multinational army like the Austro-Hungarian army. When I saw more or less the great empire be dissolving over the nationalist problem, I served in a battery in which 11 different languages were spoken in a single battery. Now that's it's bound to draw your attention to the problems of political organization. And it was during a war service in Italy that I more or less decided to do economics. But I really got hooked and found Menger's Grundsätze is such a fascinating book, so satisfying that well, even then, see, I came back, had to study law in order to be able to do economics, but was about equally interested in economics and psychology while doing a law degree, and finally had to choose between the things I was interested in. And since for economics, at least, I had a formal legitimation by a degree, while in psychology I had nothing, and there was no opportunity of a job, I decided for economics.
I seem to recall you telling a story in Claremont that you presided over the retreat of some troops. You were a lieutenant and ran into quite an interesting...
Well, it's not very interesting. Yes, on the retreat from the Piave, were first pursued by the Italians, and for that purpose, I was in... I was telephone officer of my regiment, which meant that I knew all the very few German-speaking men, which was the only reliable man in these conditions. So I was asked to take form a little detachment for the artillery regiment, first as a rear guard against the Italians following us, and then as advance guard as we were passing the Yugoslav part, where there were irregular Yugoslav cadres who were trying to stop us and get our guns. And on that occasion, after having fought for a year without even having to do a thing like that, I had to attack a firing machine gun in the night. By the time I got to the machine gun, they had gone. But it was an unpleasant experience.
Your name, of course, is closely associated with Mises. What do you feel that the most important influences he had on you were?
That's, of course, a big order to answer, because while I owe him a great deal, I owe perhaps most to him that while he was very persuasive, I was never quite convinced by his arguments. And I frequently find my own explanation, usually finding that he was right in the conclusions without his arguments completely satisfying me. And my interests have been very much guided by him, both the interest in money, industrial fluctuations, and the interest in socialism comes very directly from his influence. But if I had been If I'd come to him as a young student, I would probably have just swallowed his views completely. As it was, I came to him already with a degree. I'd finished my elementary course, so I approached him in a slightly more critical fashion. And being for 10 years in close contact with a man with whom conclusions you on the whole agreed, but whose arguments were not always perfectly convincing to you, was a great stimulus. As I said, in most instances, I found he was simply right, but in some instances, particularly as a philosophical background, I think I should put it that way, Mises remained to the end a utilitarian and rationalist. I came to the conclusion that both utilitarianism as a philosophy and the idea that we were guided mostly by rational calculations just would not be true. And that led me to my latest development, the insight that we largely had learned certain practices which were efficient without really understanding why we did it, so that it was wrong to interpret the economic system on the basis of rational action. It was probably much truer that we had learned certain rules of conduct which were traditional in our society, and the problem of why we did so was a problem of selective evolution rather than rational construction.
How about the work of Frank Knight, especially his work on uncertainty? How big an influence did that have on you?
Comparatively little, because I came across it too late. I found it extremely satisfactory when I became acquainted with it, but that was after I'd gone to London, so at a comparatively late stage. At that stage, Lionel Robbins used the first introductory chapters of that book as elementary textbook on economics. My students were all brought up on it, so I had very carefully to study it. But as I say, at a stage when my ideas were fairly definitely formed, I liked it very much. And I think the stress on the risk problem had some influence on me, but only contributing influence. It fitted in with my thinking rather than starting something new.
So that book was not a part of the intellectual material of Vienna of the 1920s.
In spite of the fact that Knight visited us once in Vienna, we made his personal acquaintance. I suppose some of my friends read his book at the time. I didn't.
How about the work of Fenner? Did that have much of an influence on you?
I knew it. In fact, I knew the old man himself. I visited him in Princeton when I was here in 23 or 24. Influence, putting it too strong, I was very interested in it, but being brought up on Böhm-Bawerk, I found it a very nice restatement, exaggerating, in my opinion, the purely psychological part of it. I think Böhm-Bawerk kept much more balance between the time preference and the productivity aspect, Fetter stressing entirely the time preference aspect. Although Mises liked it very much, I think Mises would have, I didn't hear him say so, but probably would have argued that Fetter was an improvement of Böhm-Bawerk. I have never been persuaded that was so.
So in the debate between Fetter and Fisher then, I guess you would come down more on the side of Fisher than Fetter.
Yes.
Looking back, it looks like there were a remarkable number of economists who later became prominent that were in Vienna in the 1920s, say. What do you attribute that to?
Well, the number wasn't so very large. It was a group of almost contemporaries. What it comes to is essentially Haberle, Machlup, Morgenstern, at that time much more influential than she has been, Rosenstein-Rodin, who wrote this very important article on marginal utility, And myself, I think that is a group.
Haberlow, was he?
I mentioned Haberlow first, I thought.
Oh, maybe. Did you?
Yes. Okay. Haberlow would come to my mind first, anyhow. Mm-hmm. When we were all about the same generation, most of us still, well, all of us, still members of the same seminar, even if we were only 2 years apart. And all members of the Mises Seminar, which I think was really much more important because it kept us together after we'd finished. The Mises Seminar was not really a university affair. It was a discussion club in his office. We called it the Mises Seminar and went on for something like 20 years. I left after 10, or no, not if you went on for 15 years. But I left in 31 when I went to London, but all the rest and Mises himself still continued until about 1936 or so. And it's really the members of this seminar who I think probably were largely encouraged to pursue economics by this discussion group of Mises, which in a way was much more important than the university. When at the university there was no inspiring teacher after Wieser had retired. Hans Meyer, his successor, well, he was a severe neurotic. He was a very intelligent and knowledgeable man, but the kind of person who never fulfilled their promises because they haven't discipline enough to force themselves to complete a piece of work of any length. Mm. And that was his tragedy because it all led to certain emotional strains in the man. He was also a difficult person to get on with. I mean, Mises was, contrary to his reputation, an extremely tolerant person. He would have anyone in his seminar who was intellectually interested. Meyer would insist that you swore by the master. Mm. And anybody who disagreed was unwelcome.
I see. Very little, or maybe even none, of Hans Meyer's work has been translated into English. Did he make any important contributions?
I'm never quite sure. When I recently expressed doubts about it, a man who's a very good judge, Lachmann, thought it was unjust. And perhaps I have forgotten, I haven't referred to them again since the time, so the evidence did not make a great impression on me. But I should not be surprised that if I return to them, I found more in them than I remember.
I see. John Hicks wrote about you, and I want to quote this quote, "When the definitive history of economic analysis during the 1930s comes to be written, a leading character in the drama, it was quite a drama, will be Professor Hayek. There was a time when the new theories of Hayek were the rivals of the new theories of Keynes," end of quote. Why do you think your theories lost out to the theories of Keynes?
Well, you know, there's two sides of it. The one is, while Keynes was disputed so long as he was alive, very much so, after his death he was raised to sainthood. And partly because Keynes himself was very willing to change his opinions. His pupils developed into an orthodoxy. And you had either to belong to the orthodoxy or not. At the same time, about the same time, I discredited myself with most of my fellow economists by writing The Road to Serfdom, which is disliked so much. So not only did my theoretical influence decline, I was well, most of the departments who became disliked me, so much so that I can feel it to the present day, that economists are very largely tend to treat me as an outsider, somebody who has discredited himself by writing a book like The Road to Serfdom, which has now become a political scientist altogether. Recently, I mean, the Hicks is probably the most outstanding symptom. There has been a revival of interest in my sort of problems. But I had a period of 20 years in which I bitterly regretted having once mentioned to my wife after Keynes' death that now Keynes is dead, I'm probably the best known economist living. Now, 10 days later, it was probably no longer true. With that very moment, Keynes became the great figure, and I was gradually forgotten as an economist. Part of his justification, I mean, I did only incidental work in economics after that. And most of what I did was counter to a present, well, yes, there's one more aspect. I never sympathized with either macroeconomics or econometrics. They became the great fashion during the period. Rather curiously, partly thanks to Keynes' influence. In the case of macroeconomics, it's clear. But Keynes himself did not think very highly of econometrics, rather the contrary. Yet somehow his stress on aggregates, on aggregate income, aggregate demand, encouraged work in both macroeconomics and econometrics. So very much against his own wishes, he became the spiritual father of this development towards a mathematical econometric economics. Now, I had always expressed my doubts about this thing, and that didn't make me very popular among the reigning generation of economists. I was just thought to be old-fashioned and no sympathy for modern ideas, that sort of thing.
I see. What is your evaluation of Hicks's book, Value and Capital?
Oh, brilliant. Absolutely first-class work at the time. So far as there is a theory of value proper, which does not extend beyond this, which doesn't really analyze it in terms of directing production, I think it's the final formulation of the theory of value. I don't think that the Samuelson improvements are really improvements beyond it. I think the Hicksian analysis in terms of rates of substitution in that narrow field is a definite achievement.
Do you think that what is now called the Keynesian Revolution should have been called the Hicksian Revolution? Was he influential in getting Keynes's ideas accepted?
Well, certainly not Hicksian Revolution. I think he tried to give it a more acceptable form, but I've recently said it probably should be called the Caldorian Revolution. Mm. Not for anything which connected with Caldor's name, but what spread it was really Lord Beveridge's book on full employment. And that was written by Mr. Nicholas Caldor, not by Lord Beveridge. Mm. Because Lord Beveridge never understood any economics.
Have the economic events since you wrote on trade cycle theory tended to strengthen or weaken your ideas on the Austrian theory of the trade cycle?
On the whole, strengthen, although I see more clearly that it is a very general schema which has to be filled in detail, that the particular form I gave it was connected with a mechanism of the gold standard, which allowed a credit expansion up to a point and then made a certain reversal possible. I always knew that in principle there was no definite time limit for the period by which you could stimulate expansion by rapidly accelerating inflation. But I just took it for granted that there was a built-in stop in the form of the gold standard. And that's why I was a little mistaken in my diagnosis of the post-war development. I knew that boom would break down, but I didn't give it as long as it actually lasted. that you could maintain an inflationary boom for something like 20 years, I did not anticipate. While on the one hand, immediately after the war, I never believed, as most of my friends did, in an impending depression, but rather anticipated an inflationary boom. My expectation would be that the inflationary boom would last 5 or 6 years, as the historical ones had done, forgetting that then the termination was due to the gold standard. That if you had no gold standard, if you could continue inflating for much longer, it was very difficult to predict how long it would last. And of course, it has lasted very much longer than I expected. Mm. But the end result was the same.
Yeah. The Austrian theory of the cycle depends very heavily on business expectations being wrong. Now, what basis do you feel that economists have for asserting that expectations regarding the future will generally be wrong?
Well, I think the general fact that booms have always appeared of a great increase of investment, large part of it proved to be erroneous, mistaken. And that, of course, fits in with the idea that a magnitude of supply of capital was made apparent, which wasn't actually existing. And the whole combination of a stimulus to investment on a large scale, followed by a period of acute scarcity of capital, fits into this idea that there has been a misdirection due to monetary influences. And that general schema, I still believe is correct, but is capable of a great many modifications, particularly in connection with where the additional money goes. You see, that's another point where I thought too much in what was true under pre-war conditions. Then all credit expansion, or nearly all, went into private investment, into accumulation of industrial capital. Since then, so much of the credit expansion has gone to where government directed it, that the misdirection may no longer be overinvestment in industrial capital, but may take any number of forms. You have really studied separately for each particular phase and situation. The typical trade cycle no longer exists, I believe. But you get very similar phenomena with all kinds of modifications. Hmm.
You've already talked a little bit about your involvement with the socialist calculation debate. What effects do you feel the debate had on the theory of socialism?
Well, of course, it had some immediate effects. I mean, when Mises started it, there was still the idea very prevalent that there was no need for calculation in terms of value at all. Then there came the idea that you could substitute the values by mathematical calculation. Then there came the idea of the possibility of socialist competition. All these were gradually repressed. But as I now see, the reason why Mises did not fully succeed is his very use of the term calculation. People just didn't see why calculation should be necessary. I mean, when I now look at the discussion at the time, and Mises asserts that calculation is impossible, I can see in the reply half the, why should we calculate? We have the technical data, we know what we want, so why calculation at all? And I think if Mises, instead of saying simply that without a market, calculation is impossible. Without a market, people, he would have said, without a market, people would not know what to produce, how much to produce, and in what manner to produce. People might have understood him. But he never put it till he assumed everyone would understand this. But apparently people didn't.
To what extent do you think the debate has slowed down the spread of national economic planning in the Western world?
Well, it's reviving again. It had died down very much. But when 2 years ago in this country, this planning bill of Senator Humphrey and the agitation of Leontief and these people came forward. I was amazed that people were again swallowing what I thought had been definitely refuted. And of course, Leontief still believes firmly in it, but I don't think he ever understood any economics. But that's a different matter.
What extent do you think that general equilibrium analysis has contributed to the belief that national economic planning is possible?
It certainly has. To what extent is very difficult to say. And that the direct significance of equilibrium analysis to the explanation of the events we observe, I never had any doubt. I thought it was a very useful concept to explain a type of order towards which the process of economics tends without ever reaching it. And I'm now trying to formulate some concept of economics as a stream that instead of equilibrating forces, we ought quite literally to think in terms of the factors which determine the movement of a flow of water in a very irregular bed. That would give us a much better conception of what it does. But ultimately, of course, it goes back to the assumption of the what the economists call pleonastically given data. This ridiculous concept that if you assume it on the fiction that you know all the facts, this conclusion which you derive from this assumption can apply directly to the world. I mean, my whole thinking on this started with my old friend Freddie Benham joking about the economists speaking about given data just to reassure themselves that what's given was really given. And that led me in part to ask to whom was the data really given. And the answer was, of course, to nobody. The economist assumes they're given to him, but that is it's a fiction. In fact, there's no one who knows all the data and the whole process, and that's what it led me to in the 30s, was the idea that the whole problem was the utilization of information dispersed among thousands of people were not possessed to anyone. And that, once you see it that way, makes it clear that the concept of equilibrium helps you in no way to plan the thing, because you could plan if you knew all the facts known to all the people, but since you can't possibly know them, the whole thing is vain and a misconception, partly inspired by this concept that there are definite data which are known to anyone. Mm-hmm.
Do you feel that mathematics has an important role to play in economic theory?
Yes, but algebraic mathematics is not quantitative mathematics. Now, algebra and mathematics are a beautiful way of describing certain patterns, quite irrespective of magnitudes. And as one great mathematician has once said, that the essence of mathematics was the making of patterns. But economists, mathematical economists, usually understand so little mathematics that they believe that all mathematics must be quantitative or numerical. And the moment you turn to accept this belief, I think the thing becomes very misleading. Misleading, at least, so far as it concerns general theory. I don't deny that statistics are very useful in informing you about the current state of affairs. But I don't think that statistical information has anything to contribute to the theoretical explanation of the process.
Interesting. What is your assessment of game theory?
Well, I don't want to be unkind to my old friend, the late Oscar Morgenstern. But while I think the book is a great mathematical achievement, the first chapter, which deals with the economics, is just wrong. And I don't think that game theory has really made an important contribution to economics, although it's a very interesting mathematical discipline.
Hmm. You have written an extraordinarily difficult book on capital theory. In my opinion, it's difficult. What message did you want to convey in that work?
Well, to put it briefly, I think it was that while Böhm-Bawerk is fundamentally right, his exposition in terms of an average period of production was so oversimplified as to mislead in the application. That if we want to think the Böhm-Bawerk idea through, we have to introduce much more complex assumptions. And once you do this, the things become so damned complicated, it's almost impossible to follow it.
Did you have any idea the work was going to be that complicated when you undertook it?
No. I certainly didn't. Very gradually dawned upon me that the whole thing seemed to change its aspect once you could not put it in the simple form that you could substitute for the range of investment periods, a simple average period of production, which involved in a way that no, that's not the right way of putting it. The average period of production is a first model showing a principle, but almost inapplicable to the real situation, where, of course, the capital which exists has never been built up consistently in the basis of a given set of expectation, but where you constantly were using accumulated real capital assets for new purposes which were not foreseen, which were originally done. The dynamic process looks very different. I think the most useful conclusions drawn from what I did are really in Lachmann's book on capital and whatever the title is, which, like so many things, I'm afraid, which I have attempted in economics, shows more a barrier to how far we can get in efficient explanation than precise explanations. I mean, all these things I have stressed, the complexity of the phenomena in general, the unknown character of the data, and so on, really much more points out limits to our possible knowledge than our contributions which make specific predictions possible. That's incidentally another reason why my views have become unpopular. The conception of scientific method became prevalent during that period, which valued all scientific theses from the nature of specific predictions at which it would lead. Now, somebody pointed out that the specific predictions which you could make were very limited, and that at most you could achieve what I sometimes call pattern predictions, or predictions of the principle. Seemed to the people who were used to the simplicity of physics or chemistry very disappointing and almost not science. Aim of science in that view was specific prediction, preferably mathematically testable. And somebody who pointed out that when you applied this principle to complex phenomena, you couldn't achieve this, seemed to the people almost deny that science was possible. Well, of course, my real aim was that the possible aims of science must be much more limited once we pass from the science of simple phenomena to the science of complex phenomena. And there the people bitterly resented that I would call physics a science of simple phenomena, which is partly a misunderstanding, because the theory of physics runs in terms of very simple equations, that the actual phenomena to which you have to apply it may be extremely complex, it's a different matter. The models of physical theory are very simple indeed, so far as they're not in the field of probability, that's another part. But this intermediate field, which we have in the social sciences, where the elements which have to be taken into account are neither few enough that you can know them all, nor sufficiently large in number that you can substitute probabilities for the individual information, the intermediate field is a difficult one. That's a field with which you have to deal both in biology and the social sciences. And their complexity becomes, I believe, an absolute barrier to the specificity of the predictions which we can arrive at. Until people learn themselves that they can't achieve this end, they will insist trying, will think somebody can't be done, is just old-fashioned and doesn't understand modern science.
I have heard you say before that in the 1920s, 1930s, you didn't regard Austrian economics as essentially any different than British economics. Looking back, do you still think that's true?
Well, if you stress essentially, yes, I think it is still true. So long as British economics at least aimed at being macroeconomics, and that was true at that time, there was no such fundamental difference. Or there must have been inherent in it a greater propensity to shift over to macroeconomics than there was in the Austrian tradition. I mean, I think historically it is true that most of the people in the Marshallian school readily switched over to macroeconomics, but the Austrians did not, but I would have especially to investigate the reasons why this happened. But my general feeling was that before Keynes helped macroeconomics to this complete temporary victory, the two traditions were closely approaching. Perhaps due to my making the acquaintance with the English tradition very much in the form of Lionel Robbins' exposition, which was half Austrian already, mm-hmm. if I had moved not to the London School of Economics but to Cambridge, I might not have felt like this.
Yeah. What do you feel saved the Austrian economists from adopting the perfect competition, perfect knowledge approach to micro problems?
Well, I don't know what, but it's very deeply embedded in the whole tradition, I think, already Mengel's resistance against mathematical economics was based on the same awareness that you deal with a phenomena where your specific information is limited, but none of them have really ever spelled it out, not even Mises adequately. It's still one of my endeavors to show why this tendency towards just can't explain it at the moment. I'm quite clear why, from the Austrian point of view, you could never be happy with a macroeconomic approach. It's almost a different view of the world from which you start. Mm-hmm. I find it much more puzzling that so many people seem to be able to live in both worlds at the same time.
Yeah. There are quite a number of young economists today who are studying your work and the work of Mises. How do you look on the new Austrian movement? You regard it as significant? How do you regard its future prospects?
Oh, certainly significant. Well, I will repeat, I believe, for the third time in this interview, I'm quite hopeful in the long run just because of this movement, which is not only those who call themselves in this country the Austrian economists. There's a similar reaction among the young people in England and in Germany, and quite recently even in France, where it came latest. So I think the intellectual movement is hurrying in the right direction. Well, it will take another 20 years before they have any influence on policy. And it's quite possible in the meantime the politicians destroy the world so thoroughly that there's no chance of the thing taking over. But I've always made it my rule not to be concerned with really current politics, but try to operate on public opinion. And so far as the movement of intellectual opinion is concerned, it is now, for the first time in my life, moving in the right direction. You know, speaking a moment about the more general political aspect of it all, I like to say that when I was a young man, only the very old man still believed in a free market system. When I was in my middle ages, almost I myself and nobody else believed in it. And now I have the pleasure of having lived long enough to see that the young people believe again in it. Now that is a very important change. Whether it comes in time to save the world, I don't know.
Looking back, your articles, The Use of Knowledge in Society and Economics and Knowledge, seem like a bridge between your economics work and your later social philosophy.
Yes.
Now, in the late 1930s, did you make a conscious decision to move in the direction of social philosophy rather than technical economics?
It came from the studies, well, I've discussed this before here, but I might just stress one thing. I was getting very much interested in the history of the ideas which had first led economics in the wrong direction. That's what I did in the Counter-Revolution of Science series of articles, which again sprung of my occupation with planning and similar things. And it was these which led me to see connections between what happened in economics and what happened in the approach to the other social sciences. So I acquired gradually a philosophy, in the first instance, because I needed it for interpreting economic phenomena, which also proved applicable to other phenomena. It's an approach to social science very much opposed to the scientific approach of sociology, but which I find appropriate to the specialized disciplines of social sciences, which means essentially economics and linguistics, which is very similar in its problems, the genesis of all kinds of social structures, but throughout opposed to sociology. And as I put it in my recent lectures, I'm very doubtful whether there is really a justification for a single theoretical science of sociology any more than there's a justification for a single theoretical science of naturology. The science has to deal with particular phenomena. It may develop a philosophy which explains how certain complexes of phenomena are ordered, but there are certainly many ordering principles operating in forming society, and each is of its own kind, and for sociologists to claim, well, sociology in a way, put differently, is the same, due to the same current to which macroeconomics is due in economics. It's a course of, well, I've never used the term before, macro-sociology instead of micro-sociology. Mm-hmm. Micro-sociology would consist of sciences like economics and linguistics and the theory of law and similar, even the theory of morals, while macro-sociology is as much a mistake as macroeconomics is.
Mm. What were the most important considerations in your leaving the field of economics and concentrating on social philosophy?
Well, it was never a deliberate decision. I was by accident led into writing that book on the road to serfdom. I found that it raised many problems to which I have no satisfactory answer and couldn't find a satisfactory answer anywhere. And when to retreat a moment for the controversial subjects, I decided to write up my ideas on psychology. I became aware of the existence of this general background of a different methodological approach to complex phenomena. And once I'd elaborated this aspect of the methodology of science, I just saw that it had even more urgent application at the moment to things like theory of politics as a theory of economics. Well, there was one more. See, there are always so many different things converging which drive one to a certain particular outcome. I did see that our present political order made it almost inevitable that governments were driven into senseless policies. Already the analysis of the road to serfdom showed to me that, in a sense, Schumpeter was right, that while socialism could never do what it promised, it was inevitable that it should come because the existing political institutions drove us into it. He didn't really explain it. But once you realize that a government which has power to discriminate in order to satisfy particular interests, if it's democratically organized, is forced to do this without limit because it's not really governed by the opinion of a democracy. It builds up a democracy by satisfying a sufficient number of special interests to have a majority support. This gave me a key to the reason why, even if people understood economics correctly, under the present system of government, they would be led into a very stupid economic policy. That's what I put it earlier to Leon Hoover, led me to my two, what I call my inventions in the economic field. On the one hand, my proposal for a system of really limited democracy, and the other, we also have a field where present government cannot pursue a sensible policy, denationalization of money, taking the control of money out of the hands of government. Now, once you are aware that, although I'm very little concerned with influencing current politics, but once you see that the current institutional setup make a good economic policy impossible, of course you're driven to ask, what can you do about this institutional setup?
Is it possible to arrange government so that they are not eventually driven to make these?
Well, that is the attempt of my law legislation of liberty to sketch a possible constitutional arrangement which I would think would do so. Question what you mean by possible. Whether it's possible to persuade people to accept such a constitution, I don't know. But there, of course, my principle comes in that I never ask what is politically possible, but always aiming at so influencing opinion as to make politically possible what today is not politically possible.
You spoke earlier of ideas that have led economists astray. What do you feel the most important of these ideas are?
Well, that's too long a story to explain it briefly. I mean, most of what I've done on the intellectual history, my study of positivism, of Kantian positivism, the origin of the idea of central direction, the idea about the utilization of dispersed knowledge, all really converge on the same point. And I think it was inevitable in a way that I was led from economics in the narrower sense to the question of social organization and appropriate governments which wouldn't avoid this governments being driven even against their better insight into stupid policies. I mean, apart from the general effect of democracy. Of course, the present position with inflation is a very clear one. I mean, to have a situation in which everybody knows that a little inflation will reduce unemployment, but that in the long run will increase it, but that the politicians are bound to be led by short-run considerations because they want immediately to be re-elected, I think, to me, proves irrefutably that so long as government has discretionary powers over money, it will be driven into more and more inflation. In fact, it's always been so, except so long as government voluntarily submitted to the discipline of the gold standard. Now, I cannot really defend the gold standard because I think it rests, its effectiveness rested in part on a superstition. And the idea that gold money as such is good is just wrong. Gold standard was good because it prevented a certain arbitrariness of government in its policy. But merely preventing even worse is not good enough, particularly if it depends on people holding certain beliefs which they no longer hold. So in my opinion, an effective restoration of the gold standard is not a thing we can hope for.
I would like to ask you a couple of questions on the background of economics, history of economic thought. How do you evaluate the influence of John Stuart Mill?
Well, you asked me at the wrong moment. I'm just drafting an article which is going to be called Mill's Muddle and the Muddle of the Middle. I'm afraid John Stuart Mill, you know, I have devoted a great time, deal of time studying his intellectual development. He has done a very great deal of harm, and the origin of it is still impossible for me to explain. That in any man, mere fact that he was taught something as a small boy should make him incapable of seeing that it is wrong, I still find very difficult to understand. And that applies especially to the labor theory of value. I mean, in the 20s and 30s, the labor theory of value was very badly shaken. In fact, there was a famous meeting of the Political Economy Club, in which I believe Torrens asked the question, what is now left of the theories of Mr. Ricardo, concluding that the theory of value has been finally exploded by Samuel Bailey. Now, I don't know whether John Stuart Mill was still young, was already a member of the Political Economy Club, but I know that his own little discussion circle devoted several meetings to a discussion of Bailey's book on value, which is one of the books that clearly refuted Ricardo. Mill was very familiar with the French discussion at the time when utility analysis was very definitely in the air. It had not become a definite formulation, but Léon Say, even the great Cournot, and there was even an English Don, Lloyd, who had developed almost a complete marginal utility theory, and I should assume Mill must have known this, that a man after this can assert of the theory of value that in the theory of value there's nothing to improve, it is certain to be for all times definite, is completely incomprehensible to me. And it had very serious consequences, because it was this belief that the theory of value was definite that led him to this curious statement that the theory of production is determined by nature. Where distribution is concerned, it's open to our modification according to our will. I'm not quoting now literally, I can't remember the form of words he uses. Now that, of course, is entirely due to the fact that he has not understood the real function of value as telling people what they ought to do. mean, if you assume that value is determined by what has been done in the past, rather than seeing that to maintain the whole structure, values are the signals people are to follow in deciding what to do, led him into this statement that distribution is a matter of arbitrary decision, and that forced him to the third great mistake in inventing the conception of social justice. Now, it means the three most important things in his book are not only completely wrong, but were extremely harmful. That's not denying that he's a very ingenious mind, and there are many little points in his book which are of great interest. I mean, Stigler, in an article which you probably remember, has pointed out his positive contribution. But I think the net effect on John Stuart Mill on economics has been devastating. And Jevons knew this. You know, Jevons regarded Mill as a thoroughly pernicious influence. And while I would never use quite as strong language, I think Jevons was fundamentally right.
Then, in your view, Marshall was wrong in his rehabilitation.
Yes. Well, I think the whole discussed before with Leon Hubert the question of the difference between the Austrian and the Cambridge school. It was Marshall with his harking back to Mill and his attempt to his famous two blades of a scissor. It's not demand only, it's not supply only, it's the scissors which determine values, which preserved this tradition. And it's out of this tradition that the whole of English socialism has sprung. And if you look at the people, whether it's the Webbs or Shaw or Bertrand Russell, the whole leaders of opinion in England beginning of the century were brought up on John Stuart Mill.
Yeah. I want to switch the topic a little bit now because we're just about out of time. I would like to ask you, what were your feelings? How did you react when you found out you had won the Nobel Prize?
Complete surprise. I mean, I hadn't expected anything less. And I didn't even approve. I didn't think that a Nobel Prize ought to be given late in life to people who had done something important in the distant past. That was certainly not the intention of Nobel himself. And I don't think it ought to be in economics. I think it ought to be given for some specific achievement in a fairly recent past. But this conferring it as a general sign of distinction on people who had given... But even so, I assumed they would treat me as too old, as already out of the running.
Hmm. Looking back over your career, how do you feel about your work, and what things do you think you might change if you had to do it again?
I don't know. I never thought about this. In spite of my age, I'm still thinking much more about the future than about the past. And it's so difficult to know what the consequences of particular actions have actually been. I mean, that all evolution is largely the product of accidents, that I would be very hard put to say what particular decisions of my own have had particular consequences. I know certain events which were extremely lucky, that I had luck in many connections, but how far my own decisions were right or wrong, that's my general view of life. We are playing a game of luck, and on the whole, I have been lucky in that game.
Well, I think we're out of time. I would like to say that those of us who have had access to your work to learn from are very lucky and also very appreciative of it.
Thank you very much.